So we have seen that if the initial, so we have a condition on the initial state. If the initial state is very spread in the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian, then this number goes like 1 over the dimension of the Hilbert space. And if this norm is order 1 because your observable is local, then you have typical values. And we would like to understand when this scenario happens physically. Okay? So the first thing that we could try is, so let me first show when this thing will actually fail. Okay. So imagine that your operator, so you choose your operator having in mind the preparation of your state, right? So you look for some particular operator. You say, okay, I know I prepared the state in this way. Now I want to look at this quantity. So I prepare my initial state in phi, and I choose the operator that I want to look at as just this. Okay. So you see, this is an operator that is, so if this is a matrix in the full Hilbert space, it's zero everywhere, okay? But then it has between two eigenstates as these matrix elements. Everything else is zero. Okay. So this is a bit special. Okay. So now we would like to compute the expectation value of A in phi t. Okay? So this is a problem. I think it's in the homework. But the result is, so let me call omega en minus em. This will be equal to 2 cosine omega t. So you see that if I plot A of t, I will have something like this. So definitely it's not equilibrated, it doesn't have typical values. Because, no, this is the average, but the probability of being away from the average is large. So I want to know from you, what do you think went wrong? Because, you know, this still must be true. What I'm saying is that now this number is not small, right? You always have some upper bound to the fluctuations. The point is whether this upper bound is small or large. So what do you think? Why this observable doesn't behave well? So this is a problem in the homework, so you will have time to think about it, but I want to know if you have some intuition of that. I don't want a formal proof. Do you have any idea as to why this one is not equilibrating. Try. Yeah.
Maybe A has large difference between the max eigenvalues, like A max and A min.
Yeah. So that's definitely, so in, this is part of the answer, okay? So, but you're right. So, you know, the, here you have some product, right? So it does not depend just on A. But there are definitely situations in which this observable has very large eigenvalues. So that's part of the answer. Okay, then you need kind of to understand why is that and to complete that. Okay, good. All right, so now let me show you instead a physical situation . So this observable is not very physical because as you can see, the strength of this matrix element depends on the amplitudes of the state. Okay? All right. But now let's see a more physical scenario. So this is fact something that is amenable to experiments. People are now able to do these experiments in the field of ultra-cold atom gases. People can observe an effective unitary evolution over long time. So experimentalists have become very good at decoupling these systems over very long times of the order of seconds, or even tens of seconds, which is a huge amount of time, so that the evolution is actually unitary. It's across the system. There is no decoherence in that range with the environment. And how do they do that? What they do is the so-called quantum quench. So this is a very physical way of having a non-trivial time evolution in a quantum system. What they do is that they have some Hamiltonian that depends on some parameters. Exactly like in our settings, right? That we have Hamiltonian that is smoothing the parameters. What are these parameters? So think of the quantumizing model. One of the parameters is the external, this decoupling with the transverse field. That's actually a knob that you have in the lab, right? You change your magnetic field, right? You can tune it up and down. Okay, so you have a Hamiltonian that depends on your parameters. And now what you do is that you prepare the system in the ground state of some value, say lambda one. Okay, so now it's in the ground state of this Hamiltonian. And so it's not evolving, right? Because it's an eigenstate. Then at t equals zero, you suddenly change your Hamiltonian. So your Hamiltonian that had some value, lambda one, you switch it to lambda two. Okay. So literally in the lab, you change your magnetic field from lambda one to lambda two suddenly. Of course, this sudden approximation is an idealization. There is a little ramp, but it's a very good approximation. It simplifies calculations, and it is actually a very good approximation. So now what happens that your state is here, but your Hamiltonian now is this one. And this is not an eigenstate of this Hamiltonian, right? So it will evolve in this way. Okay. So this is a quantum quench. And for instance, so think of the quantumizing model. You can actually solve exactly this problem because you know everything. You know the full spectrum. In particular, something that you can do is keep this thing like this. And then you can write psi 0 lambda 1 in the basis of H2. Right? So this will be now these are eigenstate of the Hamiltonian lambda 2. So all you have to do using the quantumizing model is to understand this change of basis, basically. And then, well, you know how this, what this does on this. This gives me e to the minus en t, just a phase, because now I wrote it in an eigenstate. So this means that you can get an analytic expression of this, right? And then what you can do is to take the overlap with your initial state, which was psi 0 lambda 1, and then take the square. Why I'm doing this? This is a quantity that is called Loschmidt-Eco. And it's very, it has a very clear physical interpretation. This is the return probability. Okay? This is the probability that the state at the psi at the time t is the state at the time 0. Okay? So plotting the Loschmidt-Eco, you would have at t equals 0 must be 1, then depending on what happens, you have, you know, how much of your state resembles the initial state. And equilibration means that you have a profile that is like this. Right? That the overlap of your state at the time t is very close to this value that should be phi bar. Phi bar is not a value, but it's what I mean is the overlap with phi bar. Okay, so now what happens if I take the time average of this guy? Is this. So this is actually a simple exercise. It's also in the homework. And guess what? This is exactly the trace of phi bar squared, which is the quantity that tells you when it's very small means I'm equilibrating. So a way of computing it is to compute this for the model that you have access to. And if you do it, so this is again an exercise. I want to give you the answer. Is if you compute it for the quantum quench in the quantumizing model, this object will be equal to the product. Okay. So remember that in the quantumizing model, all the information about the lambdas is encoded in the thetas, Remember the angle thetas? Okay. So you have theta lambda. So for instance, theta of lambda 1. Then you have theta of lambda 2. Right? So an important quantity is how much you changed lambda, but actually what matters is how much the thetas that depend on k were changed. So let me call this chi k. Right? So you, simply you compute the theta for the first Hamiltonian for the second Hamiltonian. If you do this calculation, take the time average of this thing, you will find that this is equal to the product of 1 minus sine square chi k over 2. So now you see that this is a number that is smaller than 1. And this is the sine square of this chi. And could happen that for some specific k, then let me think.
What is the k?
Yeah?
What is the k index?
Is the one in the quantum massing model, right? So you remember that that our Hamiltonian to start with is diagonalized in K space in this way. And that your ground state is the tensor product over K of these pairs of particle antiparticle of the Bogoliubov fermions. And everything here depends on lambda. This and also these operators depend on lambda. Okay. Well, so now you see this is a number smaller than 1. And you multiply, and k runs from 1 to n. Remember the number of spins. So this goes like e to the minus n, which means 1 over the dimension of the space. So you see, this is a physical case in which actually this trace of phi bar squared, this purity is very small. And therefore, because of our theorem, if you are measuring a reasonable observable, the temporal fluctuations will be very small. Okay. Now I want to show you another theorem and I will not do the proof because the content of this theorem is very similar to this one. Okay, it's just in a form that later will be more useful. And that, let me see where I have it here. And you find the proof in the lecture notes, okay? And the proof is pretty straightforward. In fact, it follows many of the passages that you have seen this morning. So you will be able to see what happens. So now this is something about this quantity. So let me call the state phi bar, which is also the h phi, let me call it omega, okay? And consider a system that is bipartite. So I consider, you know, just part of my Hilbert space is the system where I can make the measurements. And the rest that I cannot look at is the buff. Okay. I mean, this is just a name. So basically what I mean is that this is the support of the local observables that we're going to measure. And I want to understand, okay, So if I have phi of t, then you know that because I'm only measuring observables on HS, all the information phi of t is contained in what? If I take phi of t and I only measure observables that have support on S, then all this information is encoded in what? The information about all the possible measurements that I can make.
Trace over B.
Yes, the trace over B of phi of t. So what I'm saying is that you know that there is this identity which actually defines what we mean by partial trace that says, okay, if I am measuring some state phi, but I have an operator on S and the identity everywhere else, and this is its expectation value, then this is equal to the trace on just the system S of OS times phi S, where phi S is defined in this way. So you know that there is this identity. If you want a proof, I don't remember, did we discuss this during this course already or not? Anyway, it is in the notes in the chapter with the review of quantum mechanics. I think we have used this stuff when we were doing the no signaling things. Okay. So this is actually the object. So this is a state on S. And depends on time, so let me call it like this. And just like you have omega, then you also have omega s, right? Which is the trace over B of omega. I can erase this, right? Now you know what is the partial state. Okay. So one thing that I can wonder is, if I make a measurement of a local observable, this means that will be a measurement on this state. And I'm asking how much this is distinguishable from a measurement on omega, which is the time average. But that if the observable is local, this means a measurement on omega s. So if I want to find the best measurement that discriminates these two states, do you know that this gives me the trace distance between these two states? I remind you that the trace distance is defined like 1/2 in norm 1. Are you familiar with the different norms in Hilbert space? Okay. All the norms have the same properties in the sense that they are positive definite and respect triangular inequality. And P norms are defined by the limit of p going to infinity is the so-called operator norm that we use many times. Now, and the one norm, then you see, is just the trace of the square root of x dagger x, which is the square root of x dagger x. If x is an Hermitian operator, is this trace of the square root of x squared. So it's this, right? Norm one. I substituted p equal one in that expression. Okay, so I'm thinking of the distance between your partial state and your reference state, that is the time average restricted to s. And now I want to take the average distance. Okay, so you see, this has the same content of our theorem there. That was the average distance of the value of some observable a to its time average. And this is just the worst case scenario, right? It's when I use the most discriminating of rank one measurements. So it's just a way to get rid of the norm of a. Okay? And okay, so theorem that is you find in the notes is equal 1/2 the square root of this guy, the dimension square of the Hilbert space on S, which is the thing that should scale, should be order one if your observable is local, times the trace of omega square, which is the trace of phi bar square, exactly like before. So this is just another version of the theorem that we proved this morning. That's why I'm not repeating the proof for this.
Can you repeat the definition of ds?
The definition of d?
Ds. ds square.
Oh, ds is just the dimension of hs. The dimension of the Hilbert space on which you are, that you are observing. And the premise is that this is local, this is not a large number, there's no scaling with the number of particles. But for, so this is the large one that contains all the, because you don't make measurements on all the spins at the same time. Right? You measure just a little bit of your system. Okay. Okay, so okay, so we have seen some cases in which this object or that object, the delta I square, which contain the same information, are large, and some cases like the quantum quench when this is small. Okay, so first of all, we have a take-home message, and it is for certain types of unitary evolution, like when I do a quantum quench, this number, these temporal fluctuations are actually very small. So we do have equilibration probability. And this is quite something, since we started yesterday by saying that equilibration in a closed quantum system is impossible. Now we understand in what sense it is possible. And we have some examples in which that actually happens. Now the question, now we switch gears and we introduce a new argument. So as you can see, these temporal fluctuations depend on this, right? And omega does depend on the initial state phi through this expression. So this result does depend on your initial state. In the case of the quantum quench, the initial state has the right properties, the quantum quench of a quantum many body system. In other cases, it does not have. Okay, so, but it does depend on the initial state. So now I want to ask you this type of question. If I look at all the possible initial states, how likely is that the initial state is a good state? By good, I mean there will be small temporal fluctuations. So this is a new way of thinking that you probably have never been subject to. So you usually have this idea that you have a state, a quantum state, and you compute things in that state. Then you start having this. Some of you that have played with mixed states know that a mixed state is a probability distribution over the states, right? So now when you compute that something in a mixed state, okay, so you are taking into account what is the probability of getting some state. But now I want to do something more extreme. I'm saying I sample the full Hilbert space, okay, with something that is like a uniform distribution. What are then the typical properties in the Hilbert space? Okay, so our goal is to understand how to make averages not in this sense, not in this sense, because you see, this depends on psi. Not in this sense, this is the temporal average, but in this sense. So this is the expectation value when psi is drawn randomly from the Hilbert space. So imagine, for instance, that I want to compute this guy. So for every psi, I have a number, which is the expectation value in that state. But now I want to average over all the states. What do I get? So this is a sample question. Okay? So it is this type of expectation values that we are not yet trained to know how to do. So we need every expectation value. As I repeated many times, means that you must have some measure theory on the ensemble on which you are computing it. So we need a mathematical interlude, because if we want to learn how to compute these averages, because then eventually I would like to compute the expectation value changing phi of this quantity, right? Because we see, oh, this is sometimes small, sometimes large. But on average, how is it? So this is my goal. And first, I need to understand what we mean by that.
Take an average over the entire Hilbert space.
Mm.
And the HB is uncontrolled by you. You can only control HS. So I think there's no sense to take an average of the entire Hilbert space.
OK, so let me. So you have a time evolution that depends on H.
Yes.
Okay. And then, okay. So this is fixed. Given your H, something happens. And now, so this defines AT.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes. Now we want to know how much AT stays away from equilibrium. How do we know? How do we measure that? We compute delta A square.
Yes.
And we know that delta A square is upper bounded by the norm of A square, which is what it is, times the trace of phi bar square. But this depends on the initial condition.
Sure.
So now I would like to know, if I vary the initial condition, this number varies, right? So you see, this number depends on phi, on my initial condition. So now I want to know the expectation value of this number when I can vary phi, and phi varies in the full Hilbert space. So is it clear what I want to do? So now, you see, we need to pay attention because we can average in many different ensembles. So we need to know what is what. Right? Because in here, for every phi, there is a temporal average. So there is first, because when you compute a t, this means the trace of a in phi. So this is the quantum mechanical average. Right? This is, if phi is pure, it is this guy. This is like an average, because this is an expectation value. But then I have the expectation value when I average over time. And now I'm saying, oh, I want to average over the initial conditions. So this is one more way of doing an expectation value. And now, okay. So you see? Before I go ahead, is this crystal clear?
Is this the same as what we say it's ensemble average?
Is it the same as?
What is normally called ensemble average, did you say?
Yes. So, I mean, these are all ensemble averages. But this is, so phi defines in some ensemble because you can expand it in a basis. T defines an ensemble because are all the values that your function of t is peaking in your time domain. And this one is another ensemble, it's the Hilbert space, is where you pick your initial condition. So every average is some ensemble average because it's the measure of a set. And here we just have many different sets that were mentioned. And they're all physically very meaningful. Okay. Okay, so our goal is to understand how to give a meaning to this expression. Right? So phi is changing your Hilbert space, and you have some function of phi, and you want to integrate it on the measure on the Hilbert space. This is what we would like to understand what it is. And the right measure is called Haar measure, okay? How do we define the Haar measure? Well, first of all, we see that pure states are mapped, can be put in a one-to-one correspondence with the unitary operators. Because starting from any reference state in your Hilbert space, for every phi, there is a unitary operator that gives you that phi starting from phi zero. Okay. So if I want to do this, I might as well do this. So I am integrating over U, over the unitary group. And now I have a function of phi means something like this. Right? Remember that phi is the density matrix of this, and now you see. Okay, so I've shifted my problem from integrating over phi to integrating over the unitary group. And this is a problem that is solved in the theory of measure because, and it's called the Haar, this measure is called the Haar measure. It always exists and it has these properties. First of all, it's normalized. And second is unitarily invariant, which means that if B is a unitary operator in the unitary group over the Hilbert space, our Hilbert space will be some n-dimensional Hilbert space. And calligraphic U n is the unitary group on that space. So for every unitary operator, then this thing is both left and right. The measure is both left and right invariant. So it has these neat properties. So this is a measure in the sense of Lebesgue. This is a good measure. Okay. I will not prove this theorem now. What I want to prove is how we use this. And so we need to recall some things about group theory, okay? So given a unitary, because you see, now here we have a function of phi. This function of phi could be anything, you know, it could be the expectation value of an operator, something, anything that you can do on phi. So the right setting is that to every u, we associate some linear operators, a matrix, that gamma u, that respects the group structure, the so-called representation. And we want also this representation to be unitary. Means that the gamma u themselves are unitary. Okay, so this is a unitary representation. Okay. Now, imagine that you have on some space calligraphic V, which is the representation space. Now imagine now that you have an operator, a linear operator on this space. I will define the average, so the expectation value of the operator X according to the R measure as this integral. So if X, where X is some Hermitian operator. Okay? So you see, I have an Hermitian operator. What can I do with the unitary representation? I can just do the adjoint action. This is what I do. I rotate it by that unitary matrix. And I sum over all the possible rotations. This is the average.
Why is not maximum mixed? I mean, why is not a proportional identity?
Huh?
Why EX is not proportional to identity? Because you take out the average.
Let's see. Let's make this calculation. Huh? But you have a very good intuition.
Because our discussion about the truncation of...
Great, but let's see, because now you will see some subtleties, okay? Okay, so first of all, so bear with me, okay? Bear with me, and then we will get at exactly what you are hinting at, and you will see why it is true in a specific case, not always, okay? So first of all, notice that this thing that I call the average operator, the expectation value of an operator, it's not a number, it's an operator. So I call it expectation value, but the average of an operator is an operator. You can see it from here, right? This, for every u, this is an operator, and I'm summing over all these operators, and sum of operators is an operator. Okay. So I would like to know how to solve this integral. And this seems like a very daunting task. But now group theory comes to the rescue, because I'm sure that in the first course, in one of the first courses that you did at Psi, you did some group theory and you saw this thing called the Schur's lemma. And I remind you what is Schur's lemma. So imagine that I have a unitary representation gamma u and some operator x. Okay? And x is in the commutant of the representation. What I mean? Then x can be written as a linear combination over the projectors onto the irreducible representation of gamma. So E belongs to the irreps of gamma. Okay, are you familiar with this theorem?
So can you give an example? Are you saying block diagonal? Can you give an example of this?
Yeah, I'm gonna give an example soon. Like, okay, so one second. And where, so I have to define who are these lambdas, then I give an example. Lambda I are given by the trace of x pi over trace of pi. Okay, so example zero. Gamma is irreducible. So if gamma is irreducible, means that it has no invariant subspaces other than the null space and the full space, right? These are the projectors onto the invariant subspaces. But if the representation is irreducible, then the all invariant subspace is the full space. Okay? So therefore, there is only this I, there is only one. It's the full space. Okay? So, oh, sorry, what I wrote here, I meant. Oh, sure. Yes. No, that's fine. Okay. Therefore, x is equal to lambda times the projector onto the full space. What is the projector onto the full linear space?
Space.
The identity. Okay. And maybe this is the version of Schur's lemma that you know, that if your representation is irreducible, then it must be proportional to, this operator must be proportional to the identity. Okay. In fact, starting from this, you can prove this as a corollary. And it's a corollary that takes 3 pages of proof. So, you know, so it's really a corollary. But it's called, it depends on the textbook. This is also called Schur's lemma. But at least for our goals, I will call it Schur's lemma. Okay. So otherwise, if your representation is not irreducible, then you have to find the irreps. OK, so let's put this. What does this have to do with my problem? Oh, sorry. OK, so this is a theorem in group theory, but I wanted to compute this. So what is the relationship between this object and this theorem. And maybe it would be better if I call this guy A, because I don't want you to think that it is the same guy that is there. Okay. Any idea? What is the relationship between these two seemingly? Very distinct facts. Remember, this is an operator. And this is an operator that lives in the representation space, right? Question, will it commute with the unitary operator, with a member of the representation? Let's try. So I want to see what happens if I take this. Let's see what happens, right? So we have gamma v integral in the u, gamma dagger u, x gamma u. Okay. Now, this is linear, right? So I can write this. Okay. So remember, this is a representation, so it respects the group structure, right? So this object is what I would call gamma associated to VU dagger. Okay. Now let's see. Now let me, but VU dagger is a unitary operator, right? Because it's the unitary group. So the product is a unitary operator. So let me call it W. Okay? So this means that U dagger is V dagger W, and that U is equal W dagger V. Okay. So let me insert these things. So this means that this is the integral over d w dagger v gamma w x gamma w dagger gamma v. But the measure is a left and right invariant for every unitary operator. So this is just the same thing of dw. And now you see that this one is what I call the expectation value of x. And now we have gamma v on the right. So they commute. Oh, this is amazing. Actually, we have already seen a property like this, right? The group average has to commute with every element of a group. Remember, we did it when we did topological order, because it's invariant under the group average. Okay. This is very interesting, because now we have solved the integral. Now we know that the expectation value of x, which is this, is the sum over the a reps of gamma of lambda I that is defined above and the projectors over these reps. See? So this integral has become find a reps. So this is a very beautiful result. Okay, so let's put the result to work. So let's start with something very simple. Remember our initial question. Now you will we will see exactly what you wanted, that I was asking, what is the expectation value of A, some operator A, if I average over all my possible states? This is our question. Let's do that. Okay. So notice that all these operations are linear, right? Because this is an integral. So I can write it. You see the power of algebra. You know, I don't have to think too much. Because A does not depend on psi. So it's a constant for this integral that goes through. So you see the expectation that the expectation value of A, if I average over all the possible states, is equal to the expectation value of A in the average state. So let's compute this guy, and then I plug it in. Epsi of psi is VU. Then I have some representation. Okay, let me call it gamma U. Psi gamma U dag. OK, so this is the integral we want to compute. Now, I already showed you how U transforms. We wrote it. How psi transforms in that way. Right? Okay, so let me put it this way. Psi belongs to the Hilbert space. So the gamma U, what representation is it? I need that to every element of the unitary group, I need an operator on the Hilbert space. And what is this operator on the Hilbert space that is unitary, it represents U? It's U itself. It's the trivial representation, right? Because U is at the same time an element in the unitary group, and it is a linear operator on the Hilbert space. So that this is a representation. And question, is there a representation reducible or irreducible? So being irreducible means that there are no invariant subspaces other than the null space and the full space. Being reducible means that there are invariant subspaces. So let's make a drawing. So imagine that there is an invariant subspace. Okay? So this is H. And these are some states in H. Being invariant, this subspace, means that when I do unitary transformation here, I don't get out of here. And is this possible? No, because remember what we said. We said that for every state, starting from any reference state, there is a unitary that takes you there. So the unitary group is irreducible. Okay, so now we know that this must be proportional to the identity. Very good. And we just need to compute lambda. Let's compute lambda. Let's use our formula. It's the trace of our only projector that we have, right? Which is the identity over our operator that is. What is the operator that we are averaging? So lambda is there. Who is playing the value, the role of A?
X.
Yeah, so so it is X, right? And what is X here? It's psi. Okay, now let's compute this. The identity times psi is?
Psi.
And the trace of psi is?
The dimension of Hilbert.
The trace of psi?
One.
Okay, it's quantum state, right? That's the trace of psi. And the trace of the identity is? Okay. So you see that this guy is the completely mixed state. This is what you wanted, right?
So why A is psi? I think it's from E psi. E psi phi or E psi.
No, this is A.
Yes.
Okay, so this is a linear combination, and it must be L lambda times the identity.
Yes. I mean, in your formula, where lambda in the second board, lambda equals to trace A pi I.
Okay, yeah, so I understand what you mean. So you say, oh, I should put this, right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, but now you see what? Yeah, I went a bit fast. Sorry, U psi, U dagger, and we are in the trace, and this is equal. Okay, the identity does nothing, right? And this is equal the integral of the trace. And so let me do first the trace. I put this here, and now this is one. So I have du times one, but du, the integral of du is one. Okay. I went a bit fast, sorry. Okay, so if you ask what is the average state in the Hilbert space, it's the completely mixed state. This actually is the meaning of the completely mixed state. It's the average state in the Hilbert space. Now I can plug this result in here, right? And we would get that this is is 1 over D, the trace of A, the identity. And the trace of A, the identity, is the sum of the eigenvalues of A over D. So if I try an operator over all the possible states in the Hilbert space, what I get is the average value of all its eigenvalues, because this is the number of eigenvalues. That is the dimension of the space. And this makes sense, because if I'm averaging over all the possible states, why one eigenvalue should be privileged over the others? It's just the uniform, the simple average over all the possible eigenvalues. Makes sense. Okay. Okay. So at this point, it seems kind of like we are trying to kill a fly with a cannon, right? I'm summoning all this math to know this, that probably there is some simpler argument. Okay. And now let's see what happens when we want to compute other things. So imagine, for instance, that I want to compute the trace of omega squared. Right? This was because we would like to understand. Remember what I said, that I said, oh, my Okay, let me write it again. My temporal fluctuations are upper bounded by this quantity. And this quantity does depend on phi. Remember, omega is phi bar. And so this depends on phi, right? And now I want to know on average how are my things. So I would like to know this average. So I want to know the average over the Hilbert space. So let me put phi so it's clear. Of the trace of omega square. And what is omega square? Is dh phi square. Okay, so this is the thing we want to compute. And now we encounter a problem, because while in this case, look, everything was linear and I was going through, now, okay, this can go here, but now I have the square. The square is non-linear. So what do we do? So there is a very useful trick in linear algebra that, in fact, you can replicate it for every power. Let me show you it first for power 2. It's called the replica trick. Okay? So imagine that you want to compute the trace of some operator squared. Then, this is an identity, what I'm writing. This is equal to the trace of some operator that I call T2, that I will explain what it is, per e times x tensor 2. So you see what I'm doing. So x squared also, is something in your original space. But it's non-linear. But x tensor 2 is an operator in h tensor h, right? So I'm paying a price. I'm doubling the dimension. Not double. I'm doubling my Hilbert space, which means I'm squaring the dimension. But now this is the trace of a linear operator on this. And I have to tell you what is T2. T2 is the permutation of order 2 operator. So it is this operator. Let me define it. So if I is a basis in H, then here I have the same basis, right? So a basis is like this. So imagine you have two spins, right? And one has basis 0, 1. The other one also has basis 0, 1. Then the basis is ij. With both ij can change from 0 to 1. And you have four values, which is OK. 2 times 2 is 4. OK. So the swap operator is this object. Now you see how this thing acts on basis states. If I apply this thing on a basis state, I permute this. And the permutation of order 2 is the swap. More generally, if I wanted to know the n power, here I would have the permutation of order n tensor n. Okay, so I'm just saying this seems incredible, but actually you can do it as an exercise. It's a very easy exercise. So, you know, a linear algebra is a very safe discipline. You just write things in a basis and compute. Right? So you just write trace, then you write this operator. And then you write x tensor 2. So if x in a basis will be x m n m n, then x tensor 2 would be sum of m n m prime n prime x m n x m prime n prime m n tensor m prime n prime. Then you compute this, and you verify that this is equal to this, that you also can compute. Right? Okay. Okay, so this is very nice, because now if I want to, I can apply it here, and I would have the expectation value of phi. And now, instead of having the trace of dh phi square, I will have t2 times dh phi tensor 2.
Trace.
And now everything is linear. So you see, this becomes the trace of T2 onto dH tensor 2 of the expectation value of phi tensor 2. Again, I don't need to think too much. It's linear, now I know I can do that. So now my goal is to compute this. Remember, before we computed the expectation value of phi, and now I want to compute the expectation value of phi tensor 2. Questions before I do that.
So yeah. I don't understand why that's linear, because I still see it as a product of two operators.
No. DH, remember what is DH. DH on some operator X is this thing. This is a linear operation.
Yeah, no, so if you square it, and then if you use that like trick.
Okay, so if I so instead of the square, now I want two copies of that. And this is all linear. Tensor product is a linear operation. Tensor product is linear. The product is not linear, tensor product.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have to do this one. Okay, and then we plug it in. Okay, so our goal is to compute the expectation value of phi tensor 2, which is, so let's write it as an integral so that we understand exactly what we are doing. We have some initial state that is phi 0, tensor 2. Okay, so what is phi tensor 2? It's phi tensor 5. Averaging over phi means averaging over u, phi 0, u dagger. So phi 0, u dagger. And then have tensor itself. Then expand this, and this become u tensor 2, phi 0 tensor 2, u dagger tensor 2. So this is what I'm trying to do. And I'm writing it this way so that it is clear what is the representation. Because now gamma to every unitary operator associates what linear operator?
U tensor 2.
U tensor 2. And now you see, then down, now this is non-trivial because this is an element of UN. And this, I see it as a linear operator onto H tensor 2, not H. So this is not a trivial representation. Now the question is, OK, it's not just U, I give you U. U, I give you two copies of U. It's not like, it doesn't look that, you know, that untrivial. Question, is this one irreducible or not? And there are two answers, the physicist answer and the mathematician answer. And you already know the physicist answer because we have already done this thing many times in disguise. The mathematician answer is what we do now, but there is a physicist answer. You have an idea?
What's the question again?
Is this representation irreducible or not?
No.
Why?
Because we can split it into kind of bipartite systems. Because it's a tensor product of
But so what does it mean to not be reducible? So let's go back to that. It means that there is?
Because these two parts are identical. So
there's
a subspace that two parts are identical. And we are in that.
Yes, yes. So if you have identical particles and you consider a symmetric state, okay? Then U tensor U gives you still a symmetric state. In fact, there are two invariant subspaces that are the completely symmetric and the completely antisymmetric one, the ones of bosons and fermions. Right? So H tensor 2 can be written as the direct sum of the two invariant of the two irreps, where H plus or minus are defined like those states in H tensor 2, such that when you exchange the two particles, you get the same state. It's the completely symmetric one. Or the completely asymmetric one, you get minus the same state. And what is the operator that is exchanging the two particles? It's our friend there, T2. So this is such that T2 psi is equal plus minus psi. OK. So we know now what is the result of this. Is lambda plus pi plus, plus lambda minus pi minus, because it's the sum over all the reps. And lambda plus is the trace of pi 0 tensor 2 pi plus over the trace of pi plus times pi plus, because it's the projector onto H plus, plus, let me be boring, the trace of phi 0 tensor 2 pi minus over the trace of pi minus times pi minus. So you see, the only thing that we need to understand is what are these projectors and then we are done. Okay. So now, how things are connected. What is this, for instance, pi plus? What is this projector?
Symmetrization.
Huh?
Symmetrization.
It's the symmetrization. Perfect. How do I symmetrize a state?
AB plus BA divided by 2.
Is AB plus BA, right, divided by 2. So what is the operator that does these things?
The T operator.
It's the identity over the full space, so let me call it H tensor 2, plus P2 over 2. Oh, what a surprise. You already know that when you have something that squares to the identity, when you have only two subspaces, they must have this form. Remember, we did it with topological order. You can see that P plus square is equal pi plus exactly for the same reasons as before, because it should be obvious to you that P tensor 2 square is the identity. Right? I swap and then I reswap. It's the identity. Okay. And the one with the minus is this one. You can also check that if I take a state and I project it, now on plus or minus, now if I operate with this, I should get plus minus that state. And the proof is exactly the same of that when we showed what are the projections onto the conserved quantities of the A operators when we did topological order. This has a completely different meaning, but it is the same math, it's the same algebra. Okay, so now we know that. Good. So you know that when I write pi plus and pi minus, I know exactly what operators they are. Because it's the identity plus or minus that operator that I gave you, the definition in a basis over 2. The only thing that is missing is to compute these traces. Okay, so let's start with this. What is the trace of pi plus? So first of all, you should know it. Because what is the trace of the completely symmetric space? Because this is what it is, right? It's the dimension of H plus. The trace of a projector is the dimension of the space on which you're projecting. So what is this? Do you remember what is the dimension of the completely symmetric space?
Plus 1 over 2.
Yeah, good. It is n times n plus 1 over 2. Let's check. So the trace of pi plus means taking the trace of this. Okay, so it is 1 over 2. What is the trace of the identity over H tensor 2? It's the dimension of H tensor 2. What is the dimension of H tensor 2?
D squared.
Huh?
D squared.
D square, yes, or I'm calling it n right now.
Okay.
Because I think I wrote the unitary group. Yeah, I'm calling it n or d. Okay, d, good, d square. Okay, plus the trace of t2. Well, this we have to do it. Okay, so let's do it. Trace of t2 means is the sum over ij. Remember, I had ij, ji, I'm taking the trace, ji, and this gives me a delta ij. So this becomes just the sum over I of ones. And this is d. Okay. And this is what your colleague said. And by the same token, the one with the minus is a completely anti-symmetric space. Okay, so we're almost done. So we know this, we know this, we know these two numbers. Okay, now we have to take these things. Now remember, what is phi 0 tensor 2? Is this state. Do you notice something about this state? What property does it have?
Symmetric.
It's symmetric. So it lives in H plus completely. It is a symmetric state. So, and of course, H plus and J minus, I wrote it here, are orthogonal spaces, right? I wrote it here. So if I project this state onto the anti-symmetric state, what do I get?
Zero.
Zero. Good. And if I project phi 0 tensor 2 on H plus, what do I get? Itself. And then a trace of this state is a trace of this is 1 times 1. It's 1. Well, of course, the trace of a state must be 1. Perfect. So we are done. So this is equal to 1 over this quantity. So it is 2 over d times d plus 1 times p plus, I plus. So the average, which if you want, you can write as the identity on H tensor 2 plus the T2 operator over D times D plus 1. So remember this result. The average two copies of a state is that operator. The identity on the two copies plus the swap over D times D plus 1. Do you agree? I just substituted where you see pi plus, I just substituted this expression. Okay. Now, okay, we have to leave. And so the next thing we can do is to take this result and plug it in here. So why don't you guys try to do it yourself? And then tomorrow morning we discuss it. Okay? And tomorrow we'll try to wrap up. There are so many other things to do and say. And maybe we can discuss a little bit of what's going to happen in part 2. Okay?